Welcome, movie lovers, for another Anatomy of a Movie, where today we talk about Solo, a Star Wars story, not to be confused with 1996's Murray Van Peebles movie of the same name.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Well, welcome back, everybody. Dimitri Panos here. And thank God I am not solo today. I have my band of rebels when we're ready to talk Solo, a Star Wars story today. Just a couple of things. If you're a regular viewer or listener of Anatomy of a Movie, welcome back. If not, just be warned, we are very spoilerific. And we will spoil the movie. Not like Bad Meat, but just the movie. So, please listen on, view on, watch on, whatever medium you have. We really appreciate you joining. And why don't I introduce you to my band of rebels today? We got Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
One of the originals of Anatomy of a Movie.
Yeah.
And then we have returning guest panelist, Christian Blatt. Welcome.
Hello. If it's a Disney property, I'll be here.
Hey.
Happy to talk Star Wars, always.
Well, glad to have you back. Glad to have you back. Phil is out tuning up the Millennium Falcon today, but he will be flying back and with us next week, I'm assuming, I hope. So let's get into Solo, a Star Wars story released by Disney. Of course, because they release, like, everything, it seems.
Yeah.
So
every other film is Disney this summer.
And once they buy Fox, everything will be Disney.
Right.
So, as we always open up every show, we open up with opinions, and I always love to defer ladies first. Marissa, what did you think about Solo?
So I was excited to see this. You know, the whole talks of Solo and the Star Wars films in the past few years. I remember when they first casted Alden, and everyone was like, kind of, not to say wishy-washy, but we're like, well, wasn't sure what to expect. But after seeing Hail Caesar about 2 years ago and knowing that he was going to be Han Solo in this film, I was like, hey, I can picture it. I can see he can get the persona, personality, charismatic. It was fun. This film was fun. Had high expectations and hit a lot of them. Really, the only adjective I can think for this film was fun.
It's a good adjective.
Yeah.
I think it's an apt adjective, because that's what I was telling people. Because I'd known people that were kind of on the fence, you know, hardcore Star Wars fans. Like, yeah, but do I need a movie about Han Solo, a young Han Solo? And I'm like, well, yeah, of course. It's, you know, it's a territory that's been well-mined in sort of expanded universe novels and comics and things. And I was like, yeah, I definitely want to see that on the big screen. I didn't know anything about Alden. Is it Einrich or Einreich? I always get his name wrong. But I didn't know anything about him going into it. And but I was just like, well, it looks cool. I am definitely ready to go on the journey. And as I was talking about beforehand, I saw it for the second time yesterday morning. So clearly, if I saw it twice, it must have done something for me. And I just found it to be fun in a way that perhaps the last couple Star Wars movies were not fun.
Yeah, and I will be the first to admit, and I believe I even said this on Meet the Movie Press some time ago, I went in with this into this movie with some misgivings. I had a reservation. You know, there was all the story, changing directors, we'll get into that, all that drama. But even the hiring of Alden, I think for me anyways, and we'll talk more marketing, but the trailers weren't selling him, and I think they did a misstep in how they put their trailers together. So when anybody asked me if I was looking forward to it, I would be wait and see. I'm cautiously optimistic, I hope. But I went in with, like I said, some reservation and misgiving. By the time the movie was done, I had a big smile on my face. And I was, this is what a Solo movie should be. And I think it was a B-movie Western set in space, which Star Wars, the original, is somewhat of a Western.
Sure.
You know, written by the Kasdans, who are no strangers. Lawrence Kasdan, no stranger to the Star Wars universe, and no strangers to writing Westerns. This had those glimpses of Silverado in there because Silverado was a fun Western. So wasn't this. You had double crosses, train heists, dastardly villains, and of course Han Solo. And I thought he won me over. He won me over. By the time, again, the end of the movie, I was like, yeah, I could see him morphing into Han Solo.
Yeah, I think going into the movie, and to your point about the way they sold it, I was excited of, like, I can't wait to see Lando, and I can't wait to see Chewie and the Falcon, and I don't know what to think about Han, but cautiously optimistic is exactly what I said. And legitimately, the movie starts, you know, and he's stolen that speeder, and I'm like, yeah, I still don't know. But within like 10, 15 minutes, I was all in. My wife kind of nailed it. When he meets Chewie, you're like, oh, yeah, this is exactly what I want. And he really won me over. The kid at the beginning of the movie who is Han Solo, it's like, it's really hard to imagine him being the Harrison Ford Han Solo we know. But then at the end of the movie, you're like, oh, yeah, he's seen some things now. And you can see that he really gets there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. And I like that progression within this movie for like the 2 hours that we were watching this film. You can see where he started and where he ended up. And Christian, like you said, you can see how he got there. I liked that it shows that he can think on the fly, quote unquote. And he's good at lying his way out of situations, which we've seen in other films.
Absolutely.
But you can see why he had to do it. And sometimes it works and sometimes it blows up in his face. But it's funny because it's a character development.
Absolutely. And, you know, two things I wanted to point out. You said, you know, 2 hour movie. I think it's clocked like in a little
2:15. Yeah, but a lot of that, yeah, there's credits at the end.
I felt that the pacing of the movie was fantastic for this kind of a movie. I
it didn't
was like,
feel long.
No, it fell short. And that to me is a strength. It's a positive, right? I liken this kid's Alden's performance to Chris Pine. Because, and here's why. Chris Pine is chosen to play Captain Kirk, right? And you're filling in these shoes of William Shatner. And wisely, J.J. Abrams and company is like, he didn't play William Shatner. He played Captain Kirk. So you can see the morph, the evolution of him going into Captain Kirk, right? And there were glimpses there. Same thing with Alden. He didn't play wisely. He did not play Harrison Ford. He played Han Solo. There's a difference. And by the end of the movie, you can see him literally morphing into the Han Solo that we all know and love. I mean, when you have an actor like Harrison Ford, it's hard to put anybody else in his shoes. Much like William Shatner, who had 50-year legacy, right, of people watching him. How do you pick somebody to play that character? And I really think that he, to everybody's point here in the panel, I think he did a really good job by the end of the movie.
Yeah, I was thinking about this movie after the fact, and that's a great comparison to Chris Pine. I was thinking of it in terms of, like, the first time you see a new James Bond. I think Daniel Craig is great, but still that first movie, you needed a few minutes. You know, you're just like, oh, this guy's James Bond. You're like, oh, I really like him. But not the first second you see him. You're like, I'm all in on this James Bond. You have to kind of win us over a little bit. Yeah. And I think that this was an example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, and I do, we're going to get into production, but since we're talking about casting, this has a multicultural cast. It has a cast of knowns, unknowns, people,
yeah.
and people that I really enjoyed. So let's talk a bit about this casting. And since we talked about Alden and him winning us over, I want to start off a little bit. I want to start off with I want to go lower to higher. So people like Thandie Newton, right? I didn't even know she was in the movie.
I didn't either.
She wasn't in the trailer. And I was like, Thandie Newton's in this?
Said, okay. What are you doing here?
I was like, what are you doing in here? Mm-hmm. But cool. Like, I liked her character, albeit short-lived. But I liked seeing her in this movie.
I think she's a great actress.
Yeah.
I mean, watching her in Westworld, her character, not to spoil anything, is like very badass. Very, you know, driven, motivated, and can face challenges and villains and stuff and hold her own. So I think she's a great actress in that because she's already established that she can do that in Westworld. She can obviously do it in this film. And she's a great dramatic actress, too. I mean, she was in Crash and all these dramatic roles. So I think she was awesome. And to see her play opposite of Woody Harrelson, who we know can be fun, X, Y, and Z, we'll get into him. But I think she was really well casted for the short amount of time she was in this film. She held her own.
And the chemistry, too, for the short amount of time worked. Like, it worked with her and Woody Harrelson. You bought them as, yeah, we're rogues, we're scoundrels, this is our life. But we want to have another life. And I bought into it. I bought into it.
To your point about it being a Western, her character is the one you kind of always need. You always need that character who's willing to blow up the bridge with them on it because, like, look, this has to get done. And I don't know. It's one of those things that you just – you need that kind of self-sacrifice. You're like, yeah, it's been a good ride, but, you know, go have the big score. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, to that, extending that point, Rio – is that character too. It's part of like the Magnificent Seven, and people, our heroes, die in the Magnificent Seven. Now, while Rio was on screen, I'm like, who's that voice? I recognize that voice. Who's that voice? And it turns out, as soon as it was done, I IMDb, oh, it's none other than, you know, entrenched in Disney. John Favreau.
Yeah.
That totally makes sense.
When I saw it yesterday morning, my friend was like, I know I recognize that voice, but it's bothering me. Who is it? Because he wasn't going to be able to concentrate on the movie. It's John Favreau.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's great. And isn't he going to be the showrunner of the Disney Star Wars series?
I
wouldn't mind if he directed a Star Wars film.
Sure.
He's great.
Yeah. He's good. And it was just... I liked Rio. I liked that character. And they sort of kind of do that psycho thing where a couple of characters of the band get killed within the first 15 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
And you don't expect it. But because they had such presence in the short time that they were there, like their deaths, I mean, for me anyway, sort of meant something. I was like sort of bummed, but you understood. Okay, that gives Han his time to pilot. Not that I got teary-eyed, but I was like, they're not going to be in the rest of the movie.
Right. And I think it goes to show that it's fun to have different types of quote-unquote nationalities, personalities in this movie, but also it shows that these guys were already here first. They had a mission. They had that same mentality of rebellion, Empire's bad, let's do X, Y, and Z. And I like that because it shows, yes, they were there first, but they had to eventually get out of the picture so Han can step in and become the person that he is. So essentially, they just had to, not to sound terrible, get out of the way so Han can take place and step up.
Sure, absolutely. So, and then from there, let's talk a little Lando. Let's talk a little bit Donald Glover. What were your thoughts on his Lando Calrissian?
Awesome.
Yeah, he was great. I'll let you elaborate on that. But,
yeah, no, you can go first.
This is what I was the most excited for because I thought Donald Glover was such a great choice before they'd ever even shot it. And like, this is going to be great. And I think that, you know, he captured the essence of Billy Dee Williams without, you know, doing an imitation of him. I think he just nailed it perfectly. And I loved everything to do with the capes and all of that, just the style and the fashion. And he was great. If there's a complaint, could have used a little more of him. But you know what? At least he really made the scenes he was in count.
Right. It was very believable how that you can tell that Han and him were friends, but like more like frenemies in a way, but on a civil level. I think Donald Glover did everything. I could picture him as young Billy Dee. And I rewatched Empire last night. I was like, yes, he nailed him so perfectly. And I love how they kind of modernized him just a little bit with the personal webcam, like a selfie video, which people of our generation know what he's doing, but it's still... helped with the technology back then, quote unquote. I loved it. He was fun. He was charismatic. I think and the way he delivered his lines was so simple and effective. Like, I hate you.
Well, you know,
funny.
Yeah, funny. Those parts were funny. I guess for me, he was a little bit too Billy Dee Williams. Other than trying to own it, I mean, I liked him. I didn't hate him. Stuff with the capes. Hysterical.
Yeah. Like, that's a custom piece when she's trying to put out the fire, yeah.
So, you know, and I love that. But to me, again, that goes to the strength of the writing, which really beefed up the characters a lot. And I really do think, too, we'll talk writing in just a bit, but I really think that the writing has a lot to be given credit for the characters that we got. And I think that the actors rose up to the level of the writing. Because there's so much going on. And as Star Wars fans, you have a lot to live up to when you're doing Billy Dee Williams and you know, especially in Empire Strikes Back, right? But you the line, "I hate you," right? It's like, and he puts his arm around him. That is such, like, that's a Han Lando moment in Solo that when you see Empire and he does this switcher, he goes, "What are you doing here?" And it was a good scene, and you can see how it translates into Empire. That's what I liked a lot about the writing and how that one scene in particular, you talked about it. It works.
There's a lot of motifs. Sorry. That's okay. There's a lot of motifs in this one that definitely go back to Empire, because when we see them like reunite, you can tell that they're giving each other a hard time, and then they embrace in a hug. And then you also saw that in Empire. And, mm-hmm. and like there were certain elements of their relationship, their friendship, that can translate throughout all these years they're friends.
Yes. And going to the point of the "I hate you," Han's response of "I know," which of course is a motif from Empire Strikes Back, right. A very famous moment. So yeah. I loved their interaction so much. And I'm sure that there'll be more Han and Lando interactions between here and Empire Strikes Back that I think will just just be even that much more fun.
Yeah.
Did you notice the helmet he was wearing?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, Woody Harrelson?
Yeah. Woody Harrelson was the same helmet. Jedi,
The Lando
that
disguise.
Lando wears Lando in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, it was great.
That was a great touch, too.
It was cool. Again, that is what part of what made Solo fun for me. Even silly things like seeing the idol from Raiders of the Lost Ark in Paul Bettany's room.
Well,
there.
Supposedly they had the items from all three of the first Indiana, actually the four Indiana Jones movies, because there's also a crystal skull. So if you look around, you can see. Yeah.
Well, you couldn't miss the big crystal skull.
So there's, but the I guess the Grail's there too. If you look, and I was looking for all of it the second time I saw it, and I didn't catch all of it. But I love those little things. Doesn't necessarily help the movie. Doesn't hurt the movie. But it's a little something extra for people that are that invested.
Well, it was just funny because the first time I saw it, I was like. Wait a minute. Is that the... I go to my friend, I go, "That's the idol. Throw me the idol. Throw me the idol and I throw you the whip." I'm like, "How did he get the idol?" I thought that was like really front and center. And then you see the big crystal skull. Yeah. That thing was huge. So, let's talk about Dryden Voss, Paul Bettany. Again, you know, so entrenched right now in the Disney... Oh, it's like, well, you're done with Vision. You want to be in the Solo movie? Yeah, all right, I'm not doing anything. You killed me.
Well, actually, Paul Bettany begged to be in this film. He wanted, I mean, like, good friends with Ron Howard, the director. He just wanted to be in the film, like a cameo as a stormtrooper. And then with the whole recasting of the directors and whatnot and reshifting of direction, that they rewrote his part into the script, so he's actually the villain. Yeah. He just wanted a cameo.
He's funny. His character is sort of kind of like the sheriff in Silverado. He's like that Western sheriff where he's very congenial and nice, but then he'll shoot you in the heart because you slighted him in one way. He sort of kind of reminded me of Brian Dennehy's character there, but I thought he was good. I liked him.
Yeah, it was great, and it's nice to see his face. You know, when he's not when he's not being Vision in the Avengers movies,
or even Agreed. Jarvis,
or Jarvis, exactly. So I thought it was great, and he was just the right tone of, you know, basically like a crime boss, where it's like sometimes you got to kill the governor. Okay, but now let's have a drink. I hate when I get worked up like that.
And right.
So I think that it was great, and you know, it's just another one of those things where it's like that's a character. Not going to get to see again, but that's all right.
Okay.
You know, I think it was fun though, and I really liked the casting.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Going into Emilia Clarke, the very adorable Emilia Clarke in this movie, and it was nice to see her outside of Game of Thrones. And I bought her as a Han Solo love interest, and again, what the movie is able to accomplish, at least for me, is when you put Kira and Solo together at the beginning of the movie, they get separated pretty quickly, right?
Yeah.
But I still, when that happened, I bought it. I was like, oh, bummer. And, you know, I'm going to come back for you. So what were your thoughts about Emilia Clarke as Kira?
See, I don't watch Game of Thrones. Right. I know. I've only seen Emilia Clarke outside of it. And right. I think she's a great actress in and of herself. So I'm sure she's amazing in Game of Thrones. Don't knock me on that. But I liked her. She was independent. But I couldn't understand her character yet because we did get a full movie of her, but we don't have enough of her character to know, is she good? Is she bad? Is she really just in this for survival and she's partnering up with all the wrong people, mostly just for her own self survival and self-preservation in that way? So I was just wondering, she seems like a good person who's just caught in a bad situation.
Yeah.
And I also don't watch Game of Thrones, so you can be mad at this whole side of the desk. Very consciously, I don't. But I saw the movie twice. It was after the second time that I'm like, oh, that's who that was. I only know her from Terminator Genesis. That's really right. The only thing I've ever seen her in.
Sure.
And I know that's not a popular entry in that franchise, but I thought she did a good job as that character.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I thought she was great. I really liked their rapport, you know, early in the movie, and then when we see that it's been a few years, there's definitely some distance, but she still has a fondness for him. And I think that's not easy to portray. You can either just be like, you know, just hot and cold, you know, and then when she comes back, she's just really icy towards him. And I think she was able to get the nuances really well.
Agreed. 100%. And she, yeah, again, and for a female character, was written with good nuance. And she performed the nuance throughout very well. I really liked her. So, yeah, kudos to her and for breaking out, being in a good franchise. And then we go on to Woody Harrelson. How many franchises can this guy try to
so
be in?
So many. Good for him.
Well, good for him. Absolutely. As Beckett, the scoundrel mentor and the leader of the pack, so to speak, I had a really good time. I enjoy, especially these later years, the roles that Harrelson goes in, whether it's on like Edge of 17 as the teacher, and he was fantastic. As Beckett and as the rogue cowboy, I mean, again, if you couldn't figure that this is a Western, the way he's slinging his guns, that scene where we're introduced to him, you understand why Han's like, wow. I thought he carried it off really well. Thought he was a fun character.
I'm always excited to see Woody Harrelson. And it's so funny when you think back to, you know, just how good he was on Cheers. And it's 35 years ago now. So it's so different from that. And you've just seen him do so many different things. And I think that, I don't know, sometimes in a movie, in a franchise like Star Wars, when you have the recognizable face, it could be distracting. But I don't think that happened in this. I think they got the perfect part for him to play. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if he'd played a Jedi, it might have been like, oh, how's Woody a Jedi? But I think this was perfect for him.
I agree. He's totally the scoundrel that you can see Han Solo trying to become until the end. And then you see where Han Solo and he split. And I think the relationship and how that relationship ended really cements where Han Solo's going forward. And it's said in the middle of the movie where Kira says, you know, you really are a good man. And he's like, no, I'm not. And he always wants to be like not the good man Solo.
Yeah.
But in the end, he is the good man. He has the heart that Beckett may not have ever had, being his duplicitous nature and, you know, that twist at the end. Let me ask you this. Did you find Beckett's betrayal a twist? Did you think that it was going to be him? Because they really did that reveal very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody betrayed the team, and you immediately think it could be Kira. And she's like, it wasn't me. Were you surprised by the twist?
I definitely was fooled for that because I did think it was Kira, and I liked. I mean, obviously, when there's the delay before somebody walks in, I'm like, oh, okay, I know who it is. But not in the moment when it's like, oh, let's have my associate come in. I'm like, well, all right, I guess it can only be one person, you know. And I think it made sense. And what also makes sense is how he tried to then like triple cross Voss, and you know, always out looking out for himself.
Yeah. How about you?
Exactly. I didn't really see him as the big twist in the end, because I thought it was also Kira as well. But it goes to show they threw us a red herring when they established his characters, like, don't trust Voss. It was like, first of all, we shouldn't trust you. And right. he was always telling us who was the villain, and he ended up doing something as duplicitous as he did. So and we saw moments where the reasons why he's like doing train heist and all this, he has good thoughts. His heart's in the right place. Just what he does is not the best way of going about it. So the twist in the end, I was like, when they had the reveal, I was like, yeah, I could believe he would also do that too.
He's like, I did tell you don't trust anybody.
Yeah. And to me that line's in like a lot of movies. It stands out to me for like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where that line comes in very important. But I think I must be the only idiot on the planet that for like 2 seconds I thought it was going to be Lando. You know, because because it is Lando who betrays them on Bespin, right? And I thought, maybe.
The way that he takes off, I think that did make sense. And I actually, now that you mentioned it, the first time I saw it, I had a little bit of a, is it Lando? I'm like, no, of course not. So, yeah, but...
no, of course not. He only turned him in bed.
It'll be later.
Lando just wanted to get the hell out.
Right.
They just went through, he's like, I'm done.
but I really liked... it was good seeing Woody Harrelson. And while we're on the Woody Harrelson... we're talking about Beckett. That character also confirmed something that the Kasdans... We'll start getting into writing for a bit, but to me, a great part of the movie was towards the very end, and the Kasdans were very adamant that they wanted to stamp the decision that Han shoots first, and to me, that was a great scene.
I think it was very important that there's no way in that situation you can't shoot first. He's like, right. and Beckett even says, I would have killed you.
Yeah.
So it's like you had to. And that's why I always believe Han always shoots first, no matter what George Lucas tried to tell me 20 years later.
Yeah. And again, I grew up with Star Wars. I was an 11-year-old kid. Yeah, I'm that old. Han always shot first, so it was always crazy to think otherwise. But I loved how the Kasdans say, and I quote, we leave no doubt that Han shoots first. And it was in mid-sentence. It wasn't like Beckett was saying, you know, I'm going to kill you now, and then he shoots him. No, he was talking. He had like a monologue, and he just shot him.
Yeah,
it was a cool scene.
It was a good shot out, and I think, and we'll get more into cinematography later. But there was a shot where when they're fighting or they're facing standoff with the pirates,
quote unquote,
there, and there was an actual shot of his hand like over his gun.
Yeah, right.
Total Western before shootout. I was like, yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah,
like, that's a good establishing shot. Definitely
absolutely.
Western, O2 Western, but definitely shows that he's willing to shoot first.
He is, and I commend the Kasdans for doing it. And again, I said at the top, they're no stranger to the Star Wars universe. So Lawrence Kasdan is no stranger to the Star Wars universe and writing Westerns. I really thought that the screenplay here really elevated everything else, and they made a space Western that's fun. Technically, it's a B movie, but we got a great chase scene. A train scene, I should say. Yeah. A train heist.
Chase scene at the beginning,
right?
For a little bit.
So I want to talk about, what are your thoughts about their screenplay and how they worked it out? Because a lot of people are like, oh, it wasn't dark enough. And I'm like, no, I think it was the perfect tone for a Solo movie.
Yeah, I was talking about this yesterday, and I think that the exact wrong approach would have been to give us Christopher Nolan or Zack Snyder's Han Solo. You know, and I know those are directors, but that sort of approach would have been completely wrong. I think there are characters in the Star Wars universe that you could certainly do that with, but Han Solo is not one of them. I think you needed to have fun. He was always very likable. You know, even in New Hope, you see it for the first time. He's like, well, that guy's taking the money and run, but we liked him. You know what? He's got his own problems to deal with. I guess it's all right. I think that they had the right tone. I'm fascinated, and I know we'll probably never really know. I'd love to know what the original screenplay was with the original directors, years before Ron Howard came in. What's so different about it? I would assume that the essence is there, but I wonder how different it was. And my gut reaction is that what we finally saw was much more fun than what they were originally commissioned.
Well, let's go into... Well, go ahead, Marissa. I'm sorry.
What I liked about the screenplay and just the story in itself, Kristen, you mentioned if Christopher Nolan did it, we'd have a completely nonlinear story going back and forth trying to figure out where the heck we are in the timeline and storyline and how they all match up. And I'm glad that this film is very linear. We went from place to place to place, system to system, situation to the next situation to the next. Like, everything wrapped within each sequence. And I liked it. It was easy to follow.
Yeah, much like the original Star Wars.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it had that feel to it. But in answer to your question, there's a great article that I'm going to be referring to right now from Variety that talks about the bumpy road to having this movie made, and to answer your question, Lawrence Kasdan was very candid about it. And again, no ill will towards the original directors, but he said it was all about tone. He said that's what wasn't working, and they weren't really the Lord and Miller weren't. They had the script, but they were doing a lot of. They were working off of a lot of improvisation, going off script a lot. And Kasdan is like, tone is everything to me. And he goes, it's what movies are made of. And I don't disagree. But there was a very complicated situation. He goes, when you go to work in the morning on a Star Wars movie, there are thousands of people waiting for you, and you have to be decisive and very quick about it. When you're making those split-second decisions, and there's like a million a day, he goes on, you're committing to a certain tone. And if the producers think that isn't the tone of the movie, you're going to have trouble. And I believe, you know, the report suggested Lord Miller had just gone overboard with improvisation. They weren't getting the tone of what the script was to be. So I found that to be very fascinating. You know, they film like, what, 3/4 of the movie? It's somewhere. I don't think we'll ever see it on Blu-ray. Like, we'll never see it, but it would be interesting to see how different and how they perceived the Kasdan script.
Yeah, I mean, it's right up there with Eric Stoltz as Marty McFly. You've seen like a few seconds of it, but even though the movie was largely filmed, they're just like, you know what, out of respect to the people who were let go, let's just not put it out there. But I don't know. I think that it's a lot different making a Star Wars movie than making 21 Jump Street, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think that people are very critical that Disney will do a lot of these sort of things where they'll replace directors, you know, one of the biggest being Edgar Wright on Ant-Man. And it's like, but it's their product, it's their vision, and you're there to do what they want. And if the collaboration doesn't work, then that's why they go separate ways. Sometimes the director leaves, sometimes the director gets asked to leave. But I think that bringing in Ron Howard, people were very critical of that. I'm like, what are you talking about? Ron Howard has made great movies. He's going to make his day. He's going to have the what's on the page is going to be caught by the camera. And what else do you need? And I think he did a great job.
Yeah, and Ron Howard, too, no stranger to fantasy. It was great to see Willow.
Yes.
Right? It's Willow. But it was great to see him because he's also so much part of the Star Wars family anyways.
Yeah.
But, you know, and Ron Howard's no stranger to filming Westerns either. So that made sense to me. You know, and credit to Lord and Miller, they really have taken the high road above, you know, in the entire thing. You know, they were interviewed not too long ago. They're at a convention, and they said, you know, it was an amazing learning experience for us. We were honored to have been part of it and to work with that cast and crew, to be part of a Star Wars movie. At the end of the day, we understand, we learned from it, and we're going to be better filmmakers because of our experience in Solo. I appreciate that. I appreciate that taking a high road and that self-introspection that they have. So
yeah, and it's not the first time that movies have changed directors mid-process. We see it all the time. And beginning of production, middle of production, it happens a lot.
And reshoots. I mean, World War Z is infamous for its entire third act reshoot, which a lot of that third act is on the Blu-ray, which I think was very bold to put on there. So you can sort of see what they were going for and how they changed it. And sometimes reshoots can make a project better. So going back to the writing, I think that, of course, Kasdan knew the tone that they wanted and how they wanted to perceive Solo. And for me, I felt the tone was... It's a Solo movie that, yeah, this is the tone it should be.
Yeah, I don't want to get bogged down in The Last Jedi, but what was missing was the feeling I had for this movie. And it wasn't, you know, you talk about the smile on your face. Smile on your face isn't there nearly enough in The Last Jedi. This, I think, is like, yeah, this is what I want. And what I like about these side stories, well, although I guess Rogue One was about something very important, but... this is like, you know what, it's not always the fate of the galaxy hangs in the balance. It's like, no, there's just some guys trying to, you know, basically make a quick buck and they're dealing with gangsters or whatever. It's like, it's a Western. I like that. I like the smaller stories. I like that everything isn't always like, oh my God, we gotta save everything. And it's like, no, we're just saving ourselves, really. And, you know, and then there's a little hint of rebellion at the end, which I think is fitting for Star Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Marissa, you were going to say.
Oh, I completely agree, and I like how this is. You can, in a sense, isolate this film from a lot of things. It is, in a way, self-contained. We'll get to the spoiler at the end, but individually, aside from everything, this really plays off by itself. Its own story. You can understand everything. You don't. We got brand new characters, but we knew who they were. Right. We don't see how they're tied to anything else.
No.
Just like the characters in Rogue One, it was kind of standalone, and they had their characters that didn't play a bigger part in the later film. So, like, in a way, I liked how this film, as simple as it was very isolated, self-contained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I at least appreciate how these characters now, well, I'll put it to you this way. Going forward, watching the original trilogy of Star Wars movies with Han Solo, knowing that these characters were a part of his life, where he came from, I think it adds to him now. Now I have a little bit of that backstory, which I found to be fascinating and fun. And they didn't need to delve into darkness, because why? There's just no need to. Han Solo is a smuggler with a heart. He's always that roguish guy. That's why Leia fell in love with him.
Yeah, it's good to skip the 3 years of atrocities that he saw as an enlisted man in the Imperial Navy, you know, which I love that as a plot point. Just like, I got to get out of here. Okay, I'm going to enlist. You know, I don't care what they believe in. I know that they're, but it's like, I got to get out of here. And I thought that was great. And I don't know if that was something that was established in, you know, whether it's canon or not. I don't know that I knew that he had ever served. So I kind of liked that. I was like, oh, this is a really interesting thing about the character that I never imagined, that, you know, he actually was in the military at some point.
I like that too. I want to bring something up, because this has actually got, there's been debate about this, when he enlists. And he's, what's your last name? And it's an Imperial officer who comes up with Solo, right? I felt it was clever. I liked it. I had no beef with it whatsoever, but a lot of people had beef with this. Let's throw it to the panel. What did you guys think?
I agree with you 100%. I'm like, oh, that's fun. That's really cool. But I then after found out, people were like, that's so stupid. That it's like, I don't know. He didn't have a last name. So I don't know. I thought it was funny. And I liked it. It's kind of a nice little explanation. I don't understand. Well, I guess I should understand why people get upset, because people get upset about everything. But I thought it was fine.
Yeah. I didn't mind it. It added to the character and just solidified the title.
Yeah. I just felt that one of the things that I sort of picked up about the character is that he really did feel alone. He didn't want to take – He probably had a family name. He just didn't want to be associated with it, you know. And if his father was a shipbuilder, because that was another little nugget I thought was cool too. Maybe the Empire would recognize that. I mean, I don't know, because Corellia, I thought it was really cool to see the Star Destroyers.
Yes.
Being like, they had these little touches as a Star Wars fan. I was like, oh, that's cool. So it didn't bother me that he said, you know what? I don't have a last name. He goes, oh, you're by yourself. I thought it was a fun way to give him Solo, Han Solo.
And it makes sense for his character, who'd been essentially, quote-unquote, living off the street, that he wouldn't have an established name or family name or surname for him. So, yeah, he is so independent. Mm-hmm. I liked it.
Yeah, it didn't bother me in the least. And then I started reading about it. I'm like going, why? But it's as you said.
Anything that happens in a movie like this, there will be someone that's upset about it.
Yeah, and they speak loud.
Yes.
They talk very loud. They're louder
than ever.
Maybe
some of them are in our chat right now. I don't know.
Maybe. I hope not. I mean, no. We can't not be the only people showing love, for this movie. Because I really think that it was a lot of fun. So much so that I saw it within 3 days of each other. I went and saw it again. And I have to say, for a second viewing, it held up very well, if not even a little bit better, because all the surprises were out of the way, so I was able to just watch it.
I always like to see a movie, from like a Marvel movie, a Star Wars movie. I always like to see it a second time, because the first time I'm just too like, yeah, but what happens next? But what happens next? What happens next? So when I can relax and be like, oh, this other part's coming up, and let me enjoy what's here right now, and then... Yeah, I don't know. And it was just like, oh, the part with the capes is coming up. I'm going to laugh again.
Yeah, so, I'm going to laugh again.
I always like to get, if I get the time, I'd like to see a movie second time still in the theater.
Yeah, and let's talk about, too, from a story perspective, and we're going to get to the twist, what that means in the Star Wars galaxy. But, the important thing between, of all the Star Wars movies, starting with Star Wars Empire Jedi, is the relationship between Han and Chewie. Even in the Christmas special, Han has to bring Chewie back to Kashyyyk for Life Day. But it's a relationship that it's a really great... They can finish each other's sentences almost. And it was interesting. I was wondering if they were going to bring up this life debt thing, because that's how this friendship started in a sense. But they still had the theme of slavery, the freedom of the slavery. I bought into it. I was like, okay. This is it. This is how Chewbacca was a slave. Of course, there was no big, it wasn't a twist. When they threw him in the pit and you heard the beast and the growl, it's like, oh, this is going to be Chewie. I thought it was great.
Again, I'm not smart enough. I thought it was going to be like a rancor or something. Right. I was just like, all right. And then I'm like, oh, it's Chewie. That makes so much sense.
See,
so,
you have the rancor. Yeah. I have Lando.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I thought the rancor. I was like, this is like Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Which was fine. But I like this because it shows that he was fighting to save his life against that they didn't just start off as friends. It had to be a relationship that was built throughout in this film.
We have to work together to get out of this.
Yeah.
And, I liked it too. My only, I guess, my slight criticism is when Chewie's throwing him around that room, any normal human being's back would have been broken.
Yes.
I mean, the force in which he was throwing him. And when he when he threw him up, that was great. He just goes flying up and down. I really like that. But that's going to bring me to another point of controversy. Okay. So then we have the touching moment when they're on on the ship. Going towards, just prior to the train heist, robbery. Yeah. And they have this dialogue, and so what's your name? He's like, Chewbacca? Now, we're going to have to come up with a nickname for that. I can't be calling you Chewbacca. And it was cemented to me that, A, they were going to be together. They were going to be partners. And people were talking, well, that's a stupid way for him to get a nickname. I'm like, is it really? I didn't think so. To me, it was very organic. Of course he's going to call him Chewie. I don't understand. What are people complaining about?
It's established that he calls him Chewie.
Yeah.
So why would you call him Chewie? Oh, because you don't want to say Chewbacca all the time. I don't know. I thought it's another cute moment.
It is a mouthful.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Baseball players. They give baseball players nicknames for the same reason.
And by the way, just because we're talking about this portion of the film, I think the first thing that I really liked that we saw Alden do is when he started speaking Wookiee. I was like already mostly won over at that point. And I liked that he didn't speak it well, and the subtitles reflected the fact that he... And Chewie's like, all right, I get it. This guy's a little bit of an idiot, but I know what he's saying,
At least he's attempting.
Yeah, and I liked how Han was like, yeah, I speak a little. We're like, oh, so it makes sense of how he can understand Chewie and like really no one else can.
And he used the word moof milker again, which is in Force Awakens. I really, as a Star Wars fan and reading some of the, well, that are no longer canon, but even some of the Star Wars Solo, Han Solo, there's a great Han Solo comic that's out that Marvel made. But I really enjoyed the beginnings of this relationship, you know. And I thought they tied it in just perfectly. And again, I thought they got the tone right. We have to work together for a cause. And when he, and how he becomes co-pilot.
Yeah.
Everything was, to me, it felt organic.
Yeah.
Nothing felt for, like, we know the end, but it's how do we get there and make it seem sort of kind of fresh.
Right. And I think that's for all the people who say, like, well, why do we need a Han Solo prequel movie? And it's like, well, because I know where it goes. It's like, yeah, but I'm kind of interested to see how we get there. It is little things like that. And I know it was in the trailer and we all saw it a bunch of times, but I do love the interactions. You're 190 years old? You look great.
You look great.
And I was just like, I think that that's funny too. It's just the, like, Chewie's like, oh, I know how to do all this stuff. You just didn't ask me to.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a great pilot. I'm a great co-pilot. So yeah. I think that the Han-Chewie relationship is so important to this movie working. You know, Han's pining away for Kira, but really the person that he needs to spend the rest of his life with is right there next to him, yeah. Chewbacca.
And it's funny because even Kira recognizes, like, go to your friend. He needs you.
And you're going to need him. I think that was a great moment in the movie.
Because, yeah, it was a cool moment. It was a really cool moment. And it was good, you know, it's good to see Chewbacca. And again, any good, you know, hero in a Western has a good friend, you know, to back him up, so to speak. So, well, why don't we get into, do we want to talk about anything else prior to we get into the, well, we already talked about one twist. We're going to talk about the other big surprise guest appearance in this movie.
Yes, spoiler.
Spoiler.
I mean, we said spoilers at the beginning of the show, and Marissa's interacting in the chat a little bit. I saw her, and it's like if you haven't seen the movie, you shouldn't be watching a show like this just yet. You should wait till you see it because we told you at the beginning that there's spoilers.
I did say that, but right?
You did. Okay, yeah, okay. And if you hadn't, I'm sure Marissa and I would have been like, so anyway, spoilers. Spoiler. You were very clear.
Okay. We're waving our hands.
And, yeah, and we're saying it again because of a big surprise that things that we would have been spoiled.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
Things that would have been spoiled up to now are just more like little like, oh, interesting story things.
Right.
But a major reveal is now something that we will talk
about. Yeah, we're going to talk about. And to the viewer or viewers, sorry. I mean, I don't want to ruin the experience. If anything, I hope it enhances your experience because now you can pick things out. But you're going to want to click off now because this is really, this one caught me off guard completely.
I was not expecting it.
Not at all.
I thought it was handled really cool as a Star Wars. So we'll just get into it.
Because we're spoiling everything. So
Crimson Dawn is the Western crime syndicate here. And we find out that Bettany's character is not the real bad guy, but he's to answer to someone else. And when we find
he's
that reveal,
he's
yeah. he's middle management.
I'm like, oh, there's someone higher than
him. He's the Dwight Schrute of this organization.
but here's the thing: it ends up being none other than Darth Maul.
And when she starts communicating and we hear the voice, I'm like, okay, so she's talking to the Emperor. I get it.
That's what I thought.
Like, of course. Yeah. Yeah. We got it. Emperor's got a hand in everything.
Yep.
And then I'm like, oh, that's not the Emperor.
Dude, I was the same way.
And look, I know that he's alive.
The hood.
Yeah. He's alive in First Clone Wars and Rebels. Yes. But I still don't expect things like that, even though they've been very clear that they do consider those things to be canon. I just didn't expect that we would actually see him. And when we did, I'm like, oh. I had a friend that I told to see it because I knew that no matter what he thought about the rest of the movie, he was going to be so excited about Darth Maul, and I was right. And it's just such a cool reveal because it's a character that he looks great and he's so awesome, and then they kill him right away in Phantom Menace. And you're like, I could have really used some more adventures with him. So I'm glad that at least the potential is there that mm-hmm. we'll see him, not even necessarily in another Solo movie. It just means that we can see him in some other, expanded standalone Star Wars movie.
Right.
Yeah, and there were some hints to Crimson Dawn. He's red.
He's red.
Makes sense. You're like, oh, duh, of course. It had to be. And I liked it because Maul for Phantom Menace, as awful as people think that movie is, whatever, he was a great villain in Menace, and he's a good villain in Rebels and in Clone Wars. So it's cool to see him back. I don't mind the fact that they brought back Maul at all, because he is an iconic character just within popular culture, within the Star Wars canon.
Right.
It's cool to see him back, because you're like, crap, what else is he going to do now? We have to watch out for him.
I agree. And again, what I really liked about his inclusion in this is that it's a real shock to everybody. But to those who don't follow Star Wars as a Star Wars fan, like, say, you know, you only watch the movies.
Right.
You don't read the books. You don't see the comic books. You've never seen Clone Wars and or Rebels. You're just watching the movies. So you haven't seen Darth Maul.
In almost 20 years. Right. Yeah.
So when it shows up, you're like, what the fuck? Like, you're like, whoa. So, and again, this is what I respected about this movie, is that they really played to everybody, not just the diehards or the nitpick or fans. Like, again, if you've only stayed, and there are people, I would say they're a majority. A lot of these people, they've watched the movies and have enjoyed them. And I thought it was really good. It's interesting about the timeline that this falls in, because we know, like, if again, just bringing Rebels in a little bit, Obi-Wan faces off again, you know, with him. He eventually meets his demise, but I like how he is now part of this crime syndicate, and it's not the Empire. And that was fascinating to me. I loved how, too, if you watch, like, his lower half was all mechanical.
The mechanical legs. Yeah. Yeah.
And then when he does this and that new lightsaber pops in, and he's like, you and I are going to be working together a lot more closely. And you just saw, gulp.
Yeah. And again, to reinforce the point that there'll always be someone that complains about everything, there's people like, well, why did he turn on his lightsaber? And I read some quotes from Ron Howard that they filmed it a few different ways, and they looked at it and they're like, you know what? It needs a little something extra. And it's just like, he's making the point to Kira, like, you know, just in case you forget, I'm in charge and I have this badass lightsaber. So see you soon. I think it was a great little punctuation on the conversation.
Too.
I love that he turned on his lightsaber.
Oh, me too.
I would have been disappointed if he didn't. I would have been one of the people complaining. I would have been like, why didn't he put on his lightsaber?
That's the thing with when we were first introduced to Maul in Phantom Menace, when they showed his double-edged sword, we were like, what the hell? That's awesome. Yeah. It was like a completely establishing a completely different lightsaber sword that we've never seen before.
Right.
So that itself became iconic. So I was like, yeah, we have to see it again if we get him back.
Yeah, and if you're going to go through the trouble of having him force grab his lightsaber, you better well freaking turn it on. Because I would have been like you. I would have been like, why not turn it on? I wanted to see it. So it was very interesting. So he is Crimson Dawn. And whether or not, you know, we'll talk about Legacy of Han Solo and if they make more sequels, and I don't want to theorize. But this is going to be a very fascinating, if they make a 2 and a 3, as to how Crimson Dawn further directs Han Solo's path. But we already see he's really no love of the Empire.
Yeah. Right? I think serving is what reminded him, like, these guys don't know what they're doing. You know, it's as with anything, it's just like there's a lot of bureaucracy, and he's even trying to question his leaders, you know, the generals or whatever. And he's just like, yeah, but why are we going that way?
Yeah.
It's like, all right, well, you're clearly not suited to be in the military if you're going to ask why.
My favorite line in that scene is like, well, it's their planet, sir. Aren't we the hostiles? I thought that was a really
great
line.
That was great, actually.
And again, it's to me, that's the Kasdan punch. So, but Darth Maul in this movie, it was like a whoa. I was like, okay,
yeah,
I'm in.
And
I
like, think, whoa.
Yeah, I totally bought into it, and it also made though too. Kira's situation, like, I got the sense that Kira was forced into a situation to get off of Corellia, and that she was forced to make some decisions that weren't morally just. And I think that the character understood this, and now she sees herself getting a little bit deeper into it. To survive, she has to. And you just, like, the gulp moment where she's like, shit, what am I going to do? Like, right. She's like, okay. And it, I thought it was a rather touching moment, too, when Han's like, come on, we got to go. She goes, I got to pick up some more trinkets. I'm right behind you. And then when you see that yacht going by, I love that shot from down looking.
Just Han looking, and Chewie looking up. And she,
and,
yeah.
And he's like, yeah. Okay, I got Chewie, you know? Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about cinematography because, Marissa, you brought this up earlier. And I think it's very important in this movie. This movie really looked good, and I've seen it on a premium large format screen. I saw it in XD both times. It looked very solid, I felt, just from its landscapes, the lighting on it, particularly when we're in the desert, and those shots, those iconic staple shots that make a Western. To your point, the blaster and unlocking it, stuff like that. The way they frame, well, another favorite scene is the way they framed when Han Solo first meets Lando. And again, it's through his through his legs. And, you know, Lando's playing cards, but it's that Western where the hero walks into a bar and there's the sort of villain, the other scoundrel.
The only thing missing were the swinging saloon doors when he walked in.
That was it? That was it? I really felt that the cinematography in this movie was, I thought it was great. I thought they did a really good job. This Bradford Young, who's worked with Ron Howard before, I thought he got the lighting. They got the Western down, and they made it a space Western, too. So I enjoyed the various landscapes and the mountains. I like the winter or the
cold. Yeah, I was going to say the snow, the desert that you referenced, and sort of the more jungle planet that we see towards the end where he finally sits down with Lando again. And when I saw it the second time, I saw it in 3D, and I'm not a huge advocate of 3D. I did think this time it actually looked great. And the cinematography was so rich that sort of the layered way that 3D works – it was actually really cool to kind of look past and into the background. So I think that the 3D actually really worked. I'll always say save your money, don't see something in 3D. But if you do see it in 3D, you will get a little something extra.
The only reason why I didn't see it in 3D, it just wasn't fitting into the times that I saw it. But you brought up cinematography. So what are your thoughts? Like, I mean, this movie looked
good, I really
right?
liked the color palette. For the most part, it was like the cold blue, saturated in some senses. I like the establishment of the different systems. From his home planet of
Corellia?
Yeah, I'm going to butcher it. Corellia. Very city, very dark and dirty drag and color palette. But then when we like shift from system to system, and especially the train sequence was amazing. That was fun to watch. And like they each planet had a different look and environment and feel.
Yeah.
And it helped with the tone.
Yeah. I felt so, you know, I feel the same way. I want to talk a little bit about the train robbery because it looked great. We had a very interesting train and train track. This was not your normal monorail system, right? So, again, harkens back to things like the Great Train Robbery. I even saw a little bit of Firefly in this movie, particularly with that the big crew. Firefly, Joss Whedon's always said, took place in the Western border, right? You had Marauders in Firefly. So I liked how you had the Marauders here, the pirates. But that train heist scene was done. And again, it had that serial-like quality because they were always running into a problem. And then the train would flip. Like, that was cool.
That was really cool.
Right?
Yeah. And then, as a Star Wars nerd, I loved that the snow troopers that we saw were different than the ones in Empire Strikes Back. They had sort of like a little bit more fur. And so then the thought in my head is, must be colder than Hoth down there. They need a little bit more.
Yeah.
I did like that with the stormtroopers. There was a line at the beginning of the film, and they're trying to leave the quote-unquote airport or wherever transport place that they are. And one of the stormtroopers was like, carry on, carry on. I was like, I wonder if that's the same one.
Carry on.
Carry on.
That's kind of a large part of your job as a stormtrooper, just carry on. It's like, nothing to see here. Go home, folks.
And then the propaganda art, too, was like really interesting. You know, and Darth Maul being in this, I didn't, you know, if that character had turned out to be the Emperor, right, because I felt the same way, I would have been, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now that the Emperor is not in this, I was like, even better. I like the fact that we hopefully won't get the Emperor or even Darth Vader. To me, it makes this more standalone in the growth of Han Solo. He enlisted in the Empire. We know that there's an Emperor, but we didn't see the Emperor's not pulling the strings on this story as of yet. But in this movie, no. And so that's what made Darth Maul even more of the surprise with the reveal. So
I also like just the establishment of the Empire and how Han knows their process, their work process. Because there was, while I was rewatching Empire again for the millionth time, it never really put two and two together. I was like, oh yeah, he knows how the Empire works. He knows their system. Yeah. And especially is like against the Empire protocol. They'll release all the trash and we'll just float away with them. I was like, how does he know that? And then knowing now that he used to work for the Empire, is like, ah, that's how he can outmaneuver him.
Knowledge did lead to a funny moment in the film where he's like, yeah, that's all right. They're not going to set a TIE fighter out after a freighter, and then they send like six. So I thought that was a great moment, and you know, Han still has a lot of things to learn, as well represented by him saying, "I have a good feeling about this." Yeah, he's like, "Oh, you'll see."
But you know, the other cool thing of that scene too. Well, let's talk a little. We haven't talked. We have to talk the Kessel Run, right?
Yeah.
So we have to talk about the punchline to the whole Kessel Run.
Yes, of course.
So. Of course, like, so Han truly is a great pilot, which leads into Empire Strikes Back, going through the asteroid field, right? Which seemed to be almost similar to the Kessel Run, what's going on there.
He has experience.
He has experience. And, but yeah, I really enjoyed, I really enjoyed the Kessel Run, how they presented it. I liked it better the second time around because I was able to at least take it all in. The first time things were happening, I'm so focused, I was trying to get a geography of what the hell is this Kessel Run. And I always seem to forget the spice mines of Kessel, that 3PO.
Yes.
Says in the opening minutes, moments of Star Wars, you know, we'll be thrown back to the spice mines of Kessel for sure. And how it all interweaves into our beautiful galaxy far, far away. But I liked the Kessel Run and how it was interpreted for this movie.
Yeah, I think it was great that we got to see it. I mean, I think that's one of those things that when you think there's going to be a standalone Han Solo prequel, you're like, well, I hope we get to see stuff like that. You know, there's a part of me that would have liked to have seen Jabba, but fortunately he's referenced in passing.
Referenced.
Yeah, which I'm like, okay, that's good. That's good enough. And but of course, as you said, the punchline for the Kessel Run, which is great because Chewie, you know, after he says like, oh, hey, Kessel Run 12 parsecs, and Chewie says something, he's like, well, you know, I rounded down, which I thought was great. I thought that was so great. Funny.
And when you think about it, he did sort of kind of cheat.
That's true.
He put an additive into his fuel.
Yeah, he put an additive into his fuel and he flew through something you're not supposed to fly through.
Right. But of course, it's Han Solo.
Yeah.
I buy it.
But it makes the line even more iconic than absolutely. It already is.
Never heard of the Millennium Falcon?
And the capabilities of the Millennium Falcon, it's probably worth at least mentioning in passing L3, who we didn't talk about. The fact that that gives us a great explanation of how the Falcon really is has an intelligence that I think is not well established in the Star Wars universe, that it's common. You know, I don't think they have a lot of artificial intelligence in there. They just have a little navigation computer. But this is like a really sophisticated high-tech thing. And I think that was the best part of the backstory of Lando, was that he had this attachment to this droid. And when I was talking about this yesterday on my personal podcast, Shameless Plug, the Blackcast, it was pointed out that when they do run into each other again in Empire, Lando says, "How are you treating my girl?" And sure, you're talking about the ship, but also that's his girl, L3. Right. And it's like, I love little things like that when it adds a little weight to something that's already come before.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I had a conversation with a friend. He's like, you know what? I'm over like sarcastic droids and blah, blah, blah. I go, I get it. But I felt that L337 had much more of a better role that led to something than, what was it, K2SO?
Yeah.
And at least, yes, because she is the Nava computer. And so whenever I hear that sound now, I can equate it to something. And the Nava computer is so important, you know. You know, going through hyperspace ain't like Dustin Croft, boy. And now you understand. And to your point about like Empire, yeah, she was a surly droid standing up for female droids and females all over the galaxy.
Droids all around. And I like and how her character was like kind of speaking to today's age of just civil rights.
Yeah.
We kind of need that. Equality everywhere. When Lando, don't be a slave.
When Lando asks, can I get you anything? Equal rights. And it's like, you know, and I know this is a character, again, because there are always people who are upset. This is a character that people don't like, but I'm like, look, annoying droids are what Star Wars is built on. I mean, we meet C-3PO in the first couple minutes. I love C-3PO. Is there a more annoying character in the Star Wars universe than C-3PO? I don't think so. Just never tell me the odds. Well, he always tells you the odds.
Shut him up or shut him down.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I think that this was a good character in the vein of all the great droids of Star Wars. And there's the added punch that she helps the Millennium Falcon be a great ship.
There's a purpose.
Yeah.
There ends up being, like, even her death, there's a purpose to it. It's not that she's just surly and this and dies. She becomes a part of the lore. And I enjoyed, again, it's just that detail that the Kasdans wrote in this that make sense. Much like the dice, you know, the hanging dice, which are in the movie Star Wars for like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
You see those hanging dice for 2 seconds in that movie. And they become a major they become like a major prop. But I enjoyed Phoebe Waller-Bridge's voicing of L337. She did not annoy me, and I think mostly because she had a purpose. She and she's the Nava computer, so I liked it. And I liked how they equated the sound to it. So turning it on, it's like, oh, okay, I like that. Yep, it was good stuff. Good sound design, and it's a great callback to everything we've known about the Millennium Falcon. Let's talk a little bit about that ship, right? You have
just
to, because, well, I wasn't a fan. Like, the first time you see it in promotions, you're like, what the hell is in that middle?
Yeah.
Like, what are they doing? Like, why? That's not the ship. And I like how they got rid of it, but it's explained as being a life pod. Or an escape pod for Lando. And Han's like, what do you need an escape pod for? Well, now we know what it can be used for. I liked how we showed...
That's how they smuggle
stuff. I like how they showed a gleaming on the inside Millennium Falcon and Han walking into it. And again, to me, the backstory was so important about, my dad used to build these ships. Yeah, I'm familiar with, like, he felt a bond, like, the second he walked on and into the cockpit, and that to me was, that was cool.
Yeah, you know? I think it's very cool, and I love when we first see the Millennium Falcon, and you're like, oh, it looks different. I'm like, oh, man, Han is just going to beat the hell out of that thing at some point in this movie. Like, you're like, I can't wait. And, yeah, because Lando, with his whole look, he's like, look, he used the ship, and it's established he's a great smuggler. I think he doesn't do a lot of risky maneuvers because that thing was in such great shape. It's like his capes, you know? It's like everything's immaculate for Lando Calrissian. And if you want to live the kind of life that Han Solo does, sometimes you're going to knock off the satellite dish. Sometimes you're going to lose a gun, you know? And it's like, we'll get new ones. It's fine. But I thought that it was so much fun to see it for the first time and then just see the way that, you know, Han treated it like a bumper car, basically.
Well, he always treats the Millennium Falcon with love. But it's interesting to me because I question how much Lando actually owned the ship, because they had to break into – not only did they have to break into a shipyard – to get it. If it's your ship, why are you breaking into your own garage, so to speak? But how did he know it got impounded? And then they break into a shipyard and then it's booted. and he didn't know that it was booted.
Yeah.
So I was like,
I like his explanation of, you know, I just had to lock it up because, you know, you never know what's going to happen these days.
Right.
You know? Can't trust this neighborhood, basically. Right. Yeah. I thought that was very funny.
Yeah. And again, as a fan, you see the evolution of the Falcon. Mm-hmm. And the Falcon, it's so fascinating because Luke Skywalker's very first words in Star Wars when he sees it, he goes, "What a piece of junk." Now, as a movie viewer, we don't know what a piece of junk in this universe, for the first time watching Star Wars, we don't know what a piece of junk looks like. So when I see the Millennium Falcon, it's like, that's a piece of junk.
I always thought that as a kid. Cool. I'm like, because I was lucky enough that I had a Millennium Falcon. I'm like, right. No, Millennium Falcon is awesome. I don't know what cool. Luke is talking about. Yeah. Your X-Wing is stupid, Luke. But I was just like, yeah, but it's like, oh, that's what it's supposed to look like. Okay, I get it. You know, now, what, 41 years later, we finally get what it's supposed to look like.
Yeah, and they even made a great joke about it in Force Awakens. Yeah. What about that ship? Nah, it's garbage. Garbage it is. And it's the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah.
Great Line of Jedi. They hate that ship. I loved how they jettisoned that escape pod, life pod. And then we get the ship that we love, all shiny white. It's like the person who gets the brand new sneakers and doesn't, don't step on my new shoes. So yeah. That was Lando and the Falcon. So when Lando comes up, I hate you.
It's such an iconic ship and in popular culture as well. But I also liked, you mentioned the evolution, but the little things that were also in it, like the compartments, and also the game.
The chess.
Yes.
The chess game. And how you can still see Chewbacca still doesn't like losing.
And he still hasn't gotten the concept of picking
it. Right. After all those years, he still doesn't like
and he
it.
Still tries to grab for them, which I thought was great. Yeah, yeah, I loved, like you're saying, Marissa, the compartments and the game and just sort of seeing the different areas. And, you know, the little touches, you're like, oh, the seats have like these yellow cushions on them. Well, at some point, right. They're gonna have to get those out for whatever reason. Right. So I thought it was great.
The ship is just a character in it.
Yeah,
itself.
Absolutely.
It's,
and literally because it has L3 inside of it, which, you know, right. It was even before this movie, the Millennium Falcon was always a character.
But these people wouldn't be anywhere without the Falcon.
No, that's true. And to that point, for a Western, it's our cowboy's horse. When George Lucas wrote the original Star Wars and he was writing the Han Solo character, not only taking from Westerns, but Lucas himself was a car guy and he grew up. I mean, American Graffiti
is.
So it was the fast car. It was the car to beat. It was the ship to beat. In a galaxy far, far away. So it has always been a great character. And whether or not he's going to, like, she's going to start up on time, or it's not my fault, you know?
And it seems like it was the first time that Han has ever experienced the jump to hyperspace.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't know what to do with himself. He's like, oh, it has that feature? Cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because however he got to be a great pilot, which there's always questions about, you know, how exactly you get to be a great pilot when you never leave your planet. Anakin as well. How did he get to be such a great pilot as a little boy? Well, I guess pod racing. But and then he never would have done the jump to hyperspace if he never left Corellia, because obviously you can't. You have to leave your world to do it. So I think he's like, well, I'm a great pilot, but oh, this is new. So I think it's a nice little touch.
Yeah, and did the Empire had a bit of a hand. I mean, he started off in flight school, before he got kicked out for not listening or taking orders, right? Which makes sense.
Definitely makes
sense. And he gets put into the infantry. So I wanted to talk a little bit, too, about music. But John Powell, I have the soundtrack, and I found that the music here was very interesting. And John Williams collaborated and did the Han Solo theme, which is fascinating to me because, you know, John Williams is so well known. I mean, not just from a recognizability factor, but one of his strengths is when he's doing a score, he writes themes, which is very rare today. There are themes in Star Wars, Princess Leia's theme, the Imperial March. We can equate certain things to what he writes as music, and he never had a Han Solo theme, which is interesting, being that he's worked pretty much in all the Star Wars movies. But he has had I felt that John Powell lifted from things like Empire Strikes Back, the asteroid belt, which
you got
used
a touch
the
of the Empire theme.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, a touch of
a touch of the Darth Vader theme in there.
Yeah, they touch on some of the familiar themes. You know, there's the theme in the Falcon that's the same, you know, theme from the original Star Wars when they're shooting the TIE fighters.
The TIE fighter fight. Yep.
Yeah. So and it's good because it's like that. Those are the moments that you want, and when you get that score, you're like, yes, this fits perfectly. This is what I want here.
Yeah. And he has Powell has a proclivity for percussion, which there's a lot of percussion throughout the soundtrack if you listen to it on its own. The Marauders, which I thought was interesting too, he uses like a choir. When they're introduced into this movie, again, nice twist I felt with the Marauder, the leader being that young girl. But I liked the Marauders and what we learned them to be. They are pirates, but they're
more like Robin Hoods.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, when the mask came off, I'm like, all right, so who is this supposed to be? I'm trying to recognize this character. I'm like, okay, no, it's just the reveal is that it's a woman. It's but a woman. I was like really trying to place the character. And I'm like, is it a young Mon Mothma? And I'm like, no, it's not that. I'm trying to fit anybody that it could possibly be. Yeah, and then, of course, it's not. Yeah.
I like the fact that it was a woman because, yes, this is a quote-unquote old story and trilogy now. It's an individual. But, like, it's an old franchise that we're very familiar. But it's in today's age and Hollywood just in itself is gearing more towards stronger women, independent women. And I like the touch that they, not to say twist, but the reveal that it was a woman. I was like, yeah, cool.
Yeah,
that's exactly where our industry is heading, to give females a better role.
I liked it too. And she has that great line that, you know, why don't you join us? Like, we could use your skills, like you're a good captive, like we could do. Nah, I'm gonna.
Yeah, and like his answer is just a non-answer. He just kind of looks at Chewie and he just shrugs. He doesn't even have like a quick like, yeah, this isn't my fight. You know, he doesn't say something, try to be pointing. He's just like, nah. Yeah. You know, and then there's always the nods to the future of like, well, maybe one day you'll feel differently.
Yeah.
Like, you're right. I doubt that, right, Chewie? Yeah. All right, let's go.
Let's go to Tatooine.
Oh, irony.
So, what else? Are we missing anything else in production that was interesting? Marissa, I'll get a throw to you if there's something that we missed.
Just so we know, it had a high production budget.
Hoofa!
There's a lot of debate in the chat as to whether it was 250 or 300 million. Yeah,
and we know there were a lot of reshoots as well.
Well, again, in there is an article in Variety about this as well. So 250 looks to be the production budget, with 150 being spent on hard drives and advertising. So that brings the total cumulative, if my math is correct, and it usually sucks, but I think I got it right, $400 million.
Right.
That's a lot of credits.
It's the highest budget for any of the Star Wars films.
So, and there was a lot of overtime, from what I understand.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And their production went well over what was originally slated, you know, to make. Being when you fire directors three quarters of the way through, you know, Ron Howard had a big task, I think, ahead of him. And it's going to be interesting because, again, we'll never know, unless there's a book written later on down the line, what he reshot. And, you know, to fit the tone that the Kasdans originally wrote the script for. And, you know, Kathleen Kennedy, who's worked with the Kasdans before, too, what they felt was the right way to go.
Yeah, I wonder how many instances there are of things that weren't even really rewritten as much as like, oh, no, the lines were all said as they were in the script, but they didn't get it, the right performances from anyone. And yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing that is fascinating, that it'd be great if we just knew what it was, just out of curiosity. I think the movie turned out great. So it's not like one of those things like, you know, there are people that are demanding a Zack Snyder cut of Justice League. It doesn't exist. Yeah. This stuff exists. Yeah. And if you don't want to show it to us, yeah, let somebody write about it. Yeah. I'm somewhat friendly with a well-known Star Wars artist named Dave Dorman, and he pointed out that there's a book of art about this movie that has some original concepts that were not in the Ron Howard version. So there's a little bit. There's some glimpses of things that you can see. I don't remember the name of the book, but if you just look for the art book about Solo, you'll find some things that aren't in there.
I might actually get that book. I love those kinds
of books. I always loved those books. Even as a kid, I had like all these sketchbooks and everything from each of the Star Wars movies.
Yeah. Yeah, so
I mean, it's awesome. It's such a visual movie and story. Mm-hmm. It has to, like, it adds so much.
Yeah, I agree. And it's just, and again, I'm like you. I wouldn't go into wanting to know about what was shot and how it affected, and as a negative, just as a movie buff, just as a movie fan.
It's curious
because
it
is part of, like, Hollywood does this all the time. And I think it's a great, I think it's a great Hollywood lesson, more so than just keeping it within, you know, it's in the Star Wars universe, but I think it's a great Hollywood lesson to learn. Like, that's why I'm fascinating. It's fascinated is like, what did they change? What version, why was this changed when Ron Howard came in? How much of it did he have to change so that they can get back on the track that they felt it needed to go on?
Even as simply as, like, I would just like whatever was considered the final shooting draft when Lord and Miller started, I'd like to read that script. And that's not even about how it was filmed. So then you'll get a little bit of a feeling of like, okay, so these things changed. And yeah, it's like you just kind of always want to know what's so different about it.
Yeah, and again, I had read in that article, again, that was in Variety, that it said that Lord and Miller really went off the page a lot, that they used, that they were encouraging a lot more improvisation than they wanted, and that they did at sometimes 30 takes. 30 takes.
That's excessive. I think the only director I can really think of off the top of my head who does more than 30 takes could be Fincher.
David O. Russell will definitely do 50 takes of picking up a pair of keys or something. I'm exaggerating, but only a little.
Yeah.
And but you're right. And those are the kind of directors that you'll let do that. I mean, you know, now that things aren't shot in film as much, it's a little easier to justify. Right. But to your point though, just as a movie buff, I always want to know things like that. Like, you know, how did the studio get involved and ruin the Magnificent Ambersons? You know, just little things like that. I always want to know. And then when you can see original cuts and things, great. But even if you don't, it's like you just read about it, and it's always kind of interesting to know those sort of
things. Especially if you like the movie. I always want to know more background about the movie, whether there was strife on set or not. I enjoy this movie. What's a lot of this history behind it? And obviously, there is history with this particular movie. And I'm just curious from a movie standpoint, and the fact that I really did like this movie. So let's move into reception. I want to talk about reception because I think marketing, and we'll talk backlash and such, which we hinted upon. So thus far, as of yesterday, May 31st, it's done, let's round up, $120 million domestically. And
for a movie that's been out 8 days, let's point that out.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I remember a day if a movie reached $100 million, that was a benchmark. Right. Now, if you don't do that in opening weekend, you're called a failure.
Yeah.
And to me, that it just makes me laugh.
Not to get too off the topic, but the perfect example of how I didn't understand box office was when the second Andrew Garfield Spider-Man came out, Amazing Spider-Man 2, it made $500 million. They're like, it was a colossal failure. I'm like, How? No. You made so much money.
But to me, the biggest tragedy is that They call it a colossal failure. They never finish that trilogy.
Yeah.
And it's like, how is that a failure in any book? Like, I don't understand, but it's Hollywood accounting.
Yeah.
So thus far, even from a foreign perspective, the movie's done about $82 million. So we're looking at worldwide $200+ million worldwide. That's half of the 400, but to do 400 million to cover cost, they would have to do almost $1 billion. Almost. So they do have an uphill. I understand they have an uphill. And they really said there was an article, again, I believe it was in Variety, that talked about they really are going to heavily rely not only on some more foreign markets opening up, but on its ancillary markets as well. Sadly, you know, it sort of kind of puts a sequel in jeopardy as to whether or not there'll be one.
It's really unfortunate because this is an earlier release, quote unquote, for this film because it's in the summer. All the other Star Wars, the most recent ones that we've had, have been in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. It's a different time of the year where people are watching movies. Everyone's going to the theaters to watch all the summer blockbusters. And it's also unfair to compare these numbers compared to the last three biggest ones as of right now has been Black Panther, Infinity War, and Deadpool. And those are all Marvel movies, and they're all Disney. And so they're comparing these numbers to those numbers, and I feel that's wrong.
The point is well made. Deadpool's technically Fox at this point, but you're right, they're Marvel properties.
But it is Marvel.
But you mentioned two movies that have come out in the last month, and so here's another one. Not everybody can get out to the movies as often as they'd like. I have two small kids. Believe me, there's a lot of stuff I don't get out to see. These are the sort of movies I make the time for. I make the time for twice. So I think you get a lot of people that just are like, oh, I still haven't seen Infinity War. Oh, I wanted to see Deadpool. Oh, and now there's Star Wars. There's just too much. But my one question about placement in sort of when it was released, we had a Star Wars movie 6 months ago. This is really soon. And I think that the way that that movie was received, Last Jedi, I think is less important. The way people all of a sudden started talking about it, I didn't love it, but people talk about it now the way they like hated that movie. And I was like, didn't you like it like 4 months ago? So I think that it comes a little too close on the heels to a highly divisive Star Wars movie. I wonder if this had come out when Rogue One came out, would it have a completely different reaction? I don't know. It's something we'll never know. But I just wonder if coming out 6 months after The Last Jedi hurt the film more than any of the other things that we're talking about.
Well, I don't think that – well, I'm not even going to just watch our Rogue One recap. I'm not going to get into Rogue One. it's an interesting idea. And growing up as a product of like the 70s and 80s, these movies came out on Memorial Day weekend or around that time.
Every 3 years. Yeah.
Every 3 years. And I know this for a fact because my birthday is on May 22nd. And part of my birthday celebration was going into Boston to see these movies. But to see Raiders of the Lost Ark, like these were summer, big time summer releases that would come out May and June, right? Like that was a big time. So a lot of people, Forbes magazine had an article that said, no, it's not Star Wars fatigue. It's all on Solo itself. And it's too bad. This movie, for whatever its reasons, it's getting this bad rap. And I don't understand why. From a critic standpoint, I believe the last I checked, Rotten Tomatoes was at 71%, right? I think Rogue One was 90 or high 80s or low 90s. Again, I don't agree with that at all, but
it's high.
It is high, but I don't understand. But I've heard people say this movie is trite. The movie is light. The movie, and I'm like, but did you ever watch Star Wars?
Yeah.
Star Wars is as simple as can be. It's a damsel who's not so much a damsel. She's pretty strong and powerful, but it's a let's save the princess.
Yeah.
We've got sword fights. We've got knights. We've got honor. We've got a scoundrel. And we've got a farm boy. And it's this really evil character versus these really good characters. We don't even see an emperor in Star Wars. We just see something. Good guys, bad guys. It's simple. It's a simple story. That's why it was so successful in the 70s. Because it gave... There was a shift. There was a shift of the tone of how movies are. And Star Wars... was Jaws, Close Encounters, and Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark played a major part in the shift of how people and why people were going to the movies, because they had something to cheer for and it was positive and they were just fun. Solo is just fun. I can go to the movies to have a good time. Does it have to be dark or too heady? That's why I like Ready Player One, because it was just fun.
Right. Also, and just the releases of the original trilogy back then in the cast that they had. They had temple actors back then. They had Billy Dee Williams. They had Harrison Ford was on his way up from these films.
I mean, especially by Return of the Jedi. By the time Return of the Jedi comes out, Harrison Ford, you know, he'd already been Indiana Jones.
Right. Alec McGinnis, you know, Alec Guinness. We had big names back then that helped bring the audience to, and they didn't have internet. The way those movies became so popular was because people were actually watching the films.
Yeah,
and the generations are just completely different of how people, why people go to the film.
I mean, and to think that George Lucas hired Alec Guinness because he was the biggest star in Star Wars.
Yeah,
like I needed somebody because nobody
Academy
knew.
Award
and to think, knew. Like next from there, probably Peter Cushing is the next person in the movie to bring people into the theater. Right. Like, oh, I like him, you know.
Recognizable
faces, and I think that I think this movie could have done better to come out next May, and I think I didn't have the bad reaction some people did when I heard that Disney was going to be making Star Wars movies. When they said they were going to put out a Star Wars movie every year, I'm like, I think that's too much. I love that the trilogy movies came out 3 years apart. We had to wait forever. Marissa, you wouldn't even understand. That wait from 1980 to 1983, Darth Vader says, Luke, I'm your father. Like, what? No, that can't be true. That doesn't even make sense. Oh, no, Han Solo's frozen. In 3 years. That's interminable.
And at the time, you didn't even necessarily know how many years it would be, because there was nothing really set. There was nothing about franchise. Like, they made the movie. Well, Star Wars is a hit. Nobody thought it was going to be a hit. So then when they go into Empire, you get dropped that bomb, and then Han Solo's in carbonite. And here's the other thing. I want to throw this meatball on the table here, because I think social media is a blessing and a curse. The blessing because of getting word out, you know, whether it's streaming, tweeting, whatever the hell it is. But it's a curse today, I think, and it's something we didn't have back then. You don't have people publicly, you don't have websites going on telling their readers, subscribers, whatever, what they feel should happen in the next movie. And then because this is happening a lot, and I think it's one of the things that pissed so many people off about Last Jedi. That's one of the things I liked about Last Jedi, is everybody had a couple of years to figure out in their head what the movie should be. And when it turned out not to be the movie that they wrote in their head, they got pissed. And that happens a lot. Go to Cinema Blend, and I guarantee you'll find some article that says the next things that need be done in the next Star Wars movie. It's like, no, they don't need to do anything from what, no, like, who put you in charge?
Yeah, based on one person's opinion.
Write a script, get it sold, and then have them change it. But Kathleen Kennedy and team, no, it doesn't have to. All the movie has to be is entertaining.
Kathleen Kennedy and J.J. Abrams know what needs to be in Episode 9. They don't need Cinema Blend. They don't need us. They don't need anybody to tell them what needs to be in it. Yeah.
I mean, when you bring up Empire Strikes Back, I mean, I think that's a great point. It's not like, I'm your father, we have to wait. It's like, it's not a question of, oh my God, how is he his father? It's a question of, is he really his father?
Is he lying?
Was he lying?
Yeah.
What the hell's going on
here? I figured he had to be lying, because it doesn't make any sense. I love Luke Skywalker. I was 4 when I saw that movie. I'm like, no, there's no way. There's no way.
Yeah. You don't want to believe it. And so there wasn't this theorizing as to what's going on. There was still the question of, and it's like, how are we going to get Han back? I had no idea he was going to be a trophy sitting on the wall at Tatooine, right? So it was like, how are we going to resolve these? I never as a kid thought, this is the way they better do it. And then, oh, well, they didn't do it my way. This movie sucks.
Yeah, if they'd done it my way, the movie would have been great.
Yeah, and that's where it's a curse today, I feel.
Yeah, like, well, I'll just use the flip side of that is that at least now the one good thing is when you do like something, you're able to much easier find like-minded people. It's like, yeah, I like that too. Star Wars is a bad example. But, you know, comic books, I didn't know that many people that read comic books. And now there's movies and everybody knows who all these characters are. So it's good. But then when you get into the... Well, I know better than the people who made the movie. Yeah. And look, there are movies that I feel like I probably knew better than the people who made the movie. It's not these ones. There's movies where I'm like, well, that third act didn't work, you know? But I don't say that that it needs to be my way. But there's definitely, you can still be critical. Yeah. But people are, there. You have a small minority of people that are so much louder than, you know, there used to be magazines that would be like, oh, here's a little bit about Return of the Jedi. Oh. Or here's what's going to happen in Revenge of the Jedi, as it was called.
Starlog.
Yeah, Starlog magazine. It came out once a month and it was like printed. Yeah, and it was just stuff that, you know, probably had been sitting around for like 6 months and they doled out a little bit. I'm like, oh, I had a picture. I remember seeing like 20 seconds of Return of the Jedi on Good Morning America. I'm like, I can't wait for that movie. Yep. It was a speeder bike chase. I still remember because it was so great. And it was like when you got little things, it was so amazing. Now it's like, hey, where's the behind the scenes on the set blog from the director telling me what's going on? Yeah. Like, I don't want that much access, but... You know, to your point,
that's
it's just
what people are conditioned to seeing.
Exactly, they are. Yeah. They want so much.
That's the exact problem with that's the exact problem with the internet because we effing millennials love to know what's up. So, and we go every single day trying to find the newest update on this is happening. This is happening. They casted this person. They're filming here. X, Y, and Z. We're so conditioned to knowing what exactly they're doing every single freaking day on production.
And allow me to add to that. They will up to release of the movie. Or like when it's in pre-production, they will search for every single spoiler possible and then release it saying this is what's gonna happen, blah blah, oh we found this out, and then like a week prior to the release of the movie, I don't want any spoilers. It's like for 5 years all you've been releasing is spoilers. Now you don't want to hear spoilers. But you're right though, watch it, like reading Starlog, there would be a picture of C-3PO on Tatooine Desert, there would be an article about it, but there were no spoilers. And sometimes we are conditioned today to getting information like this, but sometimes that hurts. And I don't know what it is with Solo necessarily. I would call it light and breezy and fun and thrilling and action, but I would never call it trite because as a Star Wars fan, and again, this is a movie that won me over. I didn't go in with the highest of expectations. So for it to win me over, I felt that was a win for them for doing this Star Wars story. It got an A- on CinemaScore, which is pretty damn good. That means the audience...
They did something, right?
And I'd say that's fairly accurate. It's not an A-plus movie, but it's definitely an A or an A-.
It's not solid great. Solid film. Solid, and I walked out with a smile.
And we each saw it a second time, so that should tell you something.
I think so. And you know what? I really am proud of my rebel friends here because this... I had hoped that we were going to be a panel of love for Solo, because maybe it'll encourage people to go back a second time and maybe appreciate it more. Or if you haven't, sorry if we spoiled.
If you stuck in this long.
But now go in and see the movie, and I think you'll come out with a good time.
People who are still unsure that like didn't want to see it and go, oh well, the box office wasn't great, so I must not see it for that reason, and I don't want to get bogged down in the tomato meter, but that is the worst indication of anything ever. And it's, you know, there's movies that have like 30s on tomato meter, and there's movies that have hundreds where you're like, no, neither of those are right.
We talk about it all the time.
Movies that are hundreds aren't even close to 100. Mm-hmm. And your movie to be a 30, I got to think of a movie I saw that was a 30. Oh, Aloha. That's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I saw it in the theater. That's probably a 30.
Our biggest disparity, Mother.
Mother. Which, that had an F on CinemaScore.
Yeah. So, that you know. But Solo is definitely worth it. Final thoughts, and again, Marissa, ladies first.
You know, it's a fun film. I personally don't even like Westerns, but I liked this film for the most part. It's fun. It's adventurous. It has a good establishment of a character that we know and love. And I'd be willing to see a second one when they follow up.
Yeah, I hope. I mean, as we referenced the fact that Beckett has a job with some gangster on Tatooine, I'm like, oh my God, this is great. So I hope they figure out a way. And look, there are movies that don't do as well as expected but still get sequels. I think Ant-Man's a perfect example. We got Ant-Man and the Wasp, so they can figure out a way to get us another Han Solo movie. Maybe it's going to be a little bit more Lando-heavy if they feel like that's going to help it. Or I think we will get another one. I just don't think it'll be in 2-3 years. Maybe 3 years. It's going to be a little while before they get another story, and I think that they'll focus it the right way. I don't know. Let's put it this way. I'm more interested in that than the Obi-Wan Kenobi movie. The Boba Fett movie I would be interested in because we know so little about him. I'm like, it's almost a blank canvas. Sure. So there's a chance for that one. But I hope we get more Solo. I agree with Merce on that.
I agree in getting more Solo. I don't want them to take too long because everybody's going to grow up.
True.
I don't want them to get that much older.
Older than Harrison Ford when they make the next one.
Good one. I really enjoyed this movie. I think it was a lot of fun. For me, the missteps, like they could have made the trailers. I think the trailers, they could have leaned a little bit more in the action. I think they actually showed too much of Alden. And I'm not dissing him. But when you're seeing him in clips and not watching that performance as the whole, I think it makes people go, he's not Harrison Ford. Ugh. No, it's like you have to give the actor the time to grow on you. And it takes minutes. They should have focused on, I felt, a lot more of the action. But listen, we have a long summer ahead of us. I think this is one of the fun movies to go see. It's perfect for summer. It's a very good popcorn movie. A lot of love for this movie. And now we have some more movies coming out later on this month alone. We'll have a Jurassic World we'll be talking about.
With Bryce Dallas Howard.
With Bryce Dallas Howard.
Ron's daughter.
So, look at that. Yeah. Keeping it in the family.
And the one thing that I'm looking forward to, the next Mission Impossible. Cannot wait for that. Cannot wait. So we've got the rest of the summer and hopefully light, fun, breezy action movies where you can just go in and walk out with a smile and felt like you had a good time. So there's nothing wrong with movies giving you a good time. You know, everybody says, oh, they're so expensive. But go and have a good time. See Solo. We thank you very much for tuning in over here and watching us at Anatomy of a Movie and putting in your time. As always, please feel free to comment on our YouTube page and iTunes. Let us know what you thought of Solo. And Marissa, where can people support you?
Everyone can follow me everywhere at Serafini TV.
Thank you very much. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ChristianDMZ. And as I shamelessly plugged earlier, my personal podcast, The Blackcast, BLADTCAST.com. We just did also an hour and a half on Solo. So if you want a total of 3 hours of Solo, come find our latest episode over there.
And hey, welcome back. Thank you very much.
Oh, I was always happy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you want me to be less than positive, then have me on to talk about Jurassic World. That thing looks terrible.
It could. Maybe it'll. Maybe like
it. That's true. It might win me over.
Yeah. But thank you again.
Oh, happy to be here.
For joining. Again, I'm Dimitri Panos. You can follow me on Twitter or support me at DMovies at DMovies1701. Thank you very much. Keep on watching. Keep on going to the movies, more importantly, because that's where we'll see you. Take care, folks.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.